From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents, context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
Stockton, California.
I live next door to Bob Saget.
Selma.
Rockridge.
Tracy, California.
Noe Valley.
Everywhere, I'm homeless.
Coming up, we'll follow two Oakland City Council members through their first 6 months on the job.
The way Oakland works right now is, well, we used to have 50 trucks, now we have two trucks, and you might be able to get four trucks, but it'll never make your city clean. It's sort of like, you can't get nothing, so tell me what piece of the crumb you want.
I know people feel that if you listened and understood, of course you would agree with what I say. That's what an advocate feels. There must be something else going on.
Then Bay Area B-Boys talk about what it takes to stay on top of their game.
What matters is you and the floor.
Putting things in motion today on Cross Currents. This year, Oakland's city council changed dramatically. Out went three established political leaders who'd each served more than 15 years. And in came three new council members, two of them political novices. Dan Kalb is an environmental policy analyst. He won his North Oakland seat with the promise of green jobs. Lynette McElhaney is an affordable housing executive. She campaigned on schools, public safety, and economic development. And she defeated a much better financed favorite to represent downtown and West Oakland. Both of them took on the job of representing a city in a precarious but hopeful place. An economic recovery nationwide means the city is growing again. But crime is up, too. In their first 6 months in office, Kalb and McElhaney saw Oakland's police department lose two police chiefs and gain even more federal oversight. Many Oakland residents hoped that these events marked a break with the past and the beginnings of real change. Reporter Charlie Mintz checked in with the new council members regularly during their first 6 months as they tried to enact their visions for a better Oakland. Here's Charlie.
Don't take the light. About 50 people are spread across the four corners of the intersection at Market and West Grand. They're chanting and waving handmade signs at the passing cars. Oakland City Council member Lynette McElhaney raises her voice with them. Her church, True Vine Ministries, organizes these rallies called stands, and McElhaney has been attending them for years.
Charlie! Did you hear me call? He's gotten lost in the crowd. Charlie!
I was just where I needed to be in the crowd.
Good deal.
The rally ends with a prayer.
Yes, Lord.
The courage to keep fighting the good fight.
Yes, Lord.
McElhaney bows her head and says amen. Then it's on to the day's next event. We get in her Prius and head downtown to meet constituents at a conference for African-American business leaders.
Wow, you seem like you're really in the swing of it.
Oh, my goodness. Hold on.
Since coming into office, she's been besieged with requests.
Somebody's here who's actually answering the phone, returning calls. And then the word was out that I talk and I'm responsive. So it's...
So what kind of people are coming to you?
Everybody.
Yeah.
Everybody.
That's the fun part of the job. But she's already had to do the hard parts. Just the week before, she'd cast a wrenching vote. Two residents a week were dying from gun violence, and city officials were desperate for an answer. They'd offered a $250,000 contract to a well-known police consultant named Bill Bratton. He was credited with helping slash New York's crime rate, but his support of a racially charged policing tactic called stop and frisk infuriated many Oaklanders. The night of the vote, they packed council chambers to denounce the contract.
It was painful because I know that there are real concerns around police brutality, particularly in African-American communities, poor communities. And I felt the weight of that.
McElhaney is African-American herself. She's lived in West Oakland for decades. She knows victims of violence, and she knows victims of racial profiling. She came into office to bridge these divides.
That night, I was undecided. I went into the vote fairly undecided. And what I left with after hearing all of that testimony was that the department was in trouble, that it needs help, that there are already these allegations of a department that's rogue. And acknowledging that, the chief acknowledged that.
She voted to approve the contract. Even though she knows it might not be enough, she says the city has to do whatever it can.
Because it is not normal to have this level of crime and violence. It is not normal to have over 100 murders a year. And it has become so common in this city to too many of us are numb to the pervasive level of violence that's here. I mean, it is awful. It is just flat out awful. And you saw the work that I do with my church, and we've been doing that for 2.5 years, and we're behind. We didn't stand for the 3 people who were shot this month. We stood today for 4 people who were shot in December, and we have to change this because those are real lives. Real lives.
A few days after I talked to Councilmember McElhaney, I head downtown to meet her colleague, Dan Kolb.
And my desk is already messy.
Kolb's district is the wealthiest in Oakland, but it has a number of trouble spots. Around the time we spoke, a bank in Temescal was robbed for the 5th time in 5 weeks. Kolb himself had been robbed at gunpoint near his house in the same neighborhood.
I do understand the feeling of the fear and helplessness, even temporary, that you have when someone has a gun in your face and they tell you what to do, and you if you're smart, you do it.
Like Councilmember McElhaney, his campaign promised economic growth and public safety. But with crime at nearly unprecedented levels, public safety was overshadowing everything else.
We're not here to plead with you. We're here to earnestly, highly suggest that you take a position very soon.
This is audio from the city council meeting where William Bratton, the controversial police consultant, was hired. The meeting was Kolb's first interaction with Oakland's vocal anti-police community as a politician rather than just a neighbor.
Parts of that hearing got a little out of hand. And I understand people's emotions get the best of them sometimes, and I understand that. But it's genuinely not helpful to anybody's cause to prevent other people from speaking and acting out in ways that are just not helpful and sometimes childish.
Like McElhaney, Kolb voted to approve the contract, which frustrated some of his constituents.
I know people feel that if you listened and understood, of course you would agree with what I say. That's what an advocate feels. And I've been an advocate for decades. I know exactly how that feels. He's like, how could this person not agree with me? It must be something else going on. For me, there's nothing else going on.
The move was a desperate measure from a desperate city. As the year went on, Kolb and McElhaney would find themselves in crises like this one over and over again. Their ultimate goal was to make Oakland prosper. But first, they needed to make it safe.
Good to see you.
Good to see you, too.
So we're just going to chat some more, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, let's get to my office here.
Next time I spoke with Councilmember Kolb, it was March. The big news was the selection of Thomas Frazier, former chief of Baltimore Police, to help reform Oakland's police department. Oakland's first police academy in 4 years was underway, and things were looking up economically. It was almost time to draft the mid-year budget, and the city would have more money than expected, thanks to a strong real estate market. But Oakland still needed far more than it had.
There's going to be some difficult choices. I'm not aware of any good choices, good options that will be on the table or are on the table. There'll be a range of bad options.
But his top priority was simple: hire more police.
I and other council members could pass all sorts of wonderful laws and fill almost every pothole. If people don't feel safe in the neighborhoods, people are not going to feel good about living in the city.
Oh, thank you, Bridget.
Yeah, go home. Get sleep. Bye-bye.
It's nearly midnight on a Tuesday. The city council has just wrapped up another 5-plus-hour weekly meeting, and McElhaney and I are back in her office.
Trust me. You remember my relationship with this office?
It's April, about a month into intense budget deliberations. And she's dismayed by the stark choices she'll soon have to make. Like how much to fund public works.
The way Oakland works right now is, well, we used to have 50 trucks. Now we have 2 trucks. And you might be able to get 4 trucks, but it'll never make your city clean. So you need to make a decision. Do you want 4 trucks or do you want a part-time librarian? I mean, it's sort of like you can't get nothing. So tell me what piece of the crumb you want. And it's so uninspiring. It's just uninspired.
By mid-month, there was a new problem. Oakland's public unions had begun demonstrating loudly in favor of raises.
No raise!
And then, just as the budget was heating up, crime did too.
Here's the budget.
The violence renewed Kolb's commitment to beefing up Oakland's police force. That meant trade-offs.
So if I say I want 33 more civilians at OPD that are currently not in the budget, and I may say, oh, well, we can't afford 33 new positions, I'm going to go for, 24 instead.
Going into June, the final days of the budget negotiations, the council was split over paying for more police and whether to give city workers raises. Council members Kolb and McElhaney found themselves working together to craft a compromise.
Yes. Ann Kernahan.
Yes.
And that those two resolutions passed with a vote of 5 ayes.
All right.
The budget passed.
And where would you like
5 yes, 3 no. There would be more money spent fixing blight and more civilian jobs in OPD, but the issue of city workers' pay wasn't resolved.
Hey, Charlie.
How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm good, thanks.
Want something cold to drink?
Councilmember McElhaney was satisfied with her role in the process. She saw herself as fighting back against a media narrative that portrayed the budget as a fight between city workers and police officers.
I didn't like that framing, and so I worked really hard to change it, to change the narrative. And for me, the narrative was, how do we slice this pie so that almost everybody can get fed? Not everybody will be fed an equal slice of pie, but everyone will equally enjoy the pie. A 2-year-old doesn't need a man's slice, right?
McElhaney and Kolb were undaunted by their first 6 months in office. In helping prepare the compromise budget, they'd shown they could get things done as elected officials. And after seeing how Oakland worked from the inside, they were hopeful about the city's future.
Do you feel kind of lucky to have been elected right as the economy starts turning around, the first budget where you can actually start spending money again and, it's not all about cutting?
I guess so. I don't have anything to compare it to. It was still very difficult. Oakland needs twice as much money to do even half of what our needs are. You know what I mean? I feel very fortunate to be leading at a time when the city is ripe and ready for change.
I'm generally optimistic by nature. I think our problems, can be reduced in magnitude. It's not going to happen overnight. I feel that we can move forward in a positive direction. I believe that 100%, and I will always believe that.
But as an elected leader, don't you sort of have to? In Oakland, I'm Charlie Mintz for Cross Currents.
What advice do you have for these new Oakland City Council members? You can let us know by leaving us a message at 415-264-7106. That number again is 415-264-7106. This is Cross Currents from KLW News. I'm Holly Kernan. One good thing that comes out of a city that's constantly evolving is art. And while art movements come and go, one particular dance style seems like it's here to stay. B-boying, or breakdancing as most people would call it, began in the Bronx in the early 70s and has since expanded internationally. As it's grown, it's changed, and that change has led to some major cultural conflicts between the younger dancers and the older ones. KLW student reporter Ben Vu, a breakdancer himself, brings us into San Francisco's small but dedicated B-boying scene.
One day, when Brian Huang was 10 years old, he was at home watching a Japanese show on TV. Almost immediately, something caught his attention.
He started breakdancing. I was like, whoa, that's awesome. And I want to be like him.
Brian saw spins. He saw rolls. He saw some crazy gravity-defying move up 3 feet in the air. He was hooked. But he didn't know anyone in San Francisco who was b-boying, so he just kept that interest in his mind. Until he went to Burton High School. That's where he met an older student who was starting a b-boying class. That's how he found his crew.
With my crew, they're like my family. They're like my second family. At lunch, We just play around, we hang around, and it's just, everything is just fun. Nothing, like, all the drama in high school. There's always a lot of drama in school. And everything is just gone. All those dramas gone. It's all about breakdancing and having fun. I love it.
Before we get too much further, let's lay down some quick definitions. First, breakdancing. It's the term most commonly used to refer to the dance, but it's also the one most b-boys dislike. The proper term for the dance style is b-boying, or breaking. Next, we have crew. That's a group of people that break together. If they're competing, then they're like a team. Then, foundation. Those are the fundamental moves b-boys incorporate into their dance. These moves are usually personalized by the b-boy to make it unique. Then, finally, biting. That's when you rip off another person's move or style. To Brian, though, b-boying isn't about definitions. It's more than just a dance style. It's a lifestyle.
What matters is you and the floor. When I'm sad, I break. When I'm mad, I break. When I'm happy, I break. Really, you can tell by a guy when he's mad, when he's breaking sometimes.
For a lot of the younger breakers in SF, no matter how chaotic their lives are, they can always rely on it. It's a form of release. Here's Herman Huang, another breaker at Burton High School.
When I'm breaking, how it feels is I really feel more of myself, and it's a really easy way for me to unplug from all my problems, because I get to really be who I am and not really be judged for it, unless it's a good way of judging, you know? And, like, it's just a really good way just to let myself out.
But while Herman and Brian know b-boying as a dance style, they have yet to know it as part of an older culture. B-boying started in the Bronx more than 40 years ago as a way for rival gangs to settle out their differences, battle over turf, or to just gain each other's respect. B-boying became an important part of hip-hop culture. It was an outlet for the youth in response to violent hardships and their struggles. It was one of the few things that they could say belonged to them. But that culture's changed since it started, and some older b-boys say a lot of the younger ones seem to lack an understanding of the b-boy culture.
This generation is kind of like very separate. Like, they're not, most b-boys or breakers or breakdancers aren't even into the music.
That's Profo Wan, a local breaking teacher in SF. He's been breaking since the late 80s and has about 20 years of experience in the Bay Area b-boying scene. He's been a major contributor to keeping the hip-hop culture alive. He judges battles, he competes in events, and he leads workshops to help spread his knowledge. And he says he can see why it's hard for younger kids to understand where b-boying came from.
I don't blame them too, because the hip-hop out in the radio right now is not the greatest, you know what I mean? They don't relate with it. A lot of the b-boys in the 80s became the gangsters and the gangster rappers. So the first thing that they saw of hip-hop was b-boying. And without that ghetto-ness, it's kind of like lost in translation. It becomes just the moves.
In other words, young breakdancers today don't understand hip-hop. They don't understand the music that goes with b-boying, and it shows when they get down on the floor. This disconnect from the hip-hop culture is related to access, something Brian Huang experienced during his middle school years.
In this community, it's really hard to find a teacher. Like, I actually recommend people learning from YouTube. At least you're learning. Just try not to hurt yourself.
What's up? This is B-Boy of Insanity, and over the next couple of months, I'm going to be teaching a series of free YouTube tutorials on breakdancing.
Brian says YouTube is okay, but Profo Wan says YouTube is the reason it's harder for teachers to reach out to students.
With there being YouTube, it's harder to guide. Before, when there was no YouTube, you would have to find someone who would know. Now that there's YouTube, where you could just access it from your living room or your bedroom, you don't need a mentor. You just see, wow, that guy did a flip, and then I'll do the flip. But then no one's teaching you about the culture. I could do it myself, There's how-to videos on YouTube. Why do I need this guy? Because his stories might be more valuable than the moves that he gives you. So you have the understanding.
So many people are teaching themselves moves on YouTube that they've got a name. E-boys. Here's him and Huang again.
What I think of E-boys, I would say they really need to find somebody who they can actually ask questions about moves, because you're seeing things on YouTube as 2D. You can't really ask them a question. You can't see if they're putting any like strain on the word, really. And then they can't really help you out or show you, and then you can walk around them and see how their arms are or anything, and then you could just hurt yourself. Yeah.
Tofu Wan says there's another issue. Most of the mainstream videos on YouTube involve power moves, the athletic and acrobatic feats. So a lot of the younger b-boys are just picking up the flashy moves they see, and that makes everyone's dancing look the same, causing the dance itself to look repetitive and bland.
So if someone throws a move, and yeah, you know you put it the way you put it together, since everything's not original, right? Everything's been taken. You know, it's the way you go into it. That's what's original. Usually what you want to do is flip it. You want to take it to another level. If he went into it this way, I'll do something different to go into it. Just try to change it, you know what I mean? Yeah.
But YouTube isn't all bad. Even Profo Wan says it has some pros to it too.
I just watched videos I didn't know that was out there, that I never had access to. I'll be like, Storm and Swift Rock, 1989. Ooh, I've never seen that. I can watch it now. Now, because of the YouTube generation, I get to put myself out there more at the same time. So I'm not against it. It's just, I would suggest that a lot of these guys, a lot of the young guys, just look for guidance. As long as we keep that open mind of like hitting up the old school guys and the original guys, it'll be a balance from the new and the old. So everyone could like benefit from it. Do you know what I mean?
And like Profo says, that's exactly what the b-boying community needs. Variety. That's something Brian Huang can agree with.
I don't want them to start thinking that all you need is power move and the cool moves that to make it all like fancy and showy. It's like your body reacting to the music, and it's like your body is the instrument you're using. Yeah.
Keeping the old hip-hop culture alive while incorporating new innovations lets everyone learn something and helps the community grow. With some moderation and thoughtful ideas, b-boying as a dance style can continue to evolve. For Cross Currents, I'm Ben Vu.
Ben Vu is a rising senior at Burton High School in San Francisco, where KALW is based. He was a summer reporting intern with us this year. You'll find links to more student stories at our website. It's kalw.org. And if you know of any b-boy acts that can't be missed, tell us about them at our Facebook page. We're KALW. And that's it for today's Cross Currents from KALW News. Our team includes Hana Ababa, Julie Kane, Jen Chien, Leela Day, Audrey Dilling, Ashley Ann Krigbaum, Chris Hoff, Linda Ju, Christina Loring, Alyssa Kapnick, Leah Rose, Stephen Short, Nina Gensler-Debs, Holly J. McDeed, Ray Sue Sussman, and Daniel Moore. Today's show was engineered by Seth Samuel. Casey Miner is our senior editor. Our managing editor is Martina Castro. Ben Trefney, who swims with the porpoises, is our executive editor. And does that sound like he's been buried underneath the sea? And thanks to you, whether you're swimming with porpoises or not, KALW is independent, listener-supported public radio.
California, you're a hole in my heart.
If you look up Goodnight, Texas, you'll discover that it's an unincorporated town with a population of less than 20 people. You'll also discover that it's the name of a San Francisco band, which you're hearing right now. Goodnight, Texas, the band, not the town, will be playing tomorrow at Café du Nord in San Francisco. Doors open at about 8 p.m. You can find all of that information along with more local music at klw.org, which is also where you can subscribe to our podcast. For Cross Currents, I'm Holly Kernan. There are the things around the bend. The bend.